The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything that you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The all-new Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third-row seating, available dual wireless charging pads ensure that you can take on any adventure. Available H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on the dirt trails and kick up some mud. Standard third-row seating so your whole family can experience the thrill together. Available dual wireless charging pads, so no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead phone. I've been so pumped to take a couple of friends with our road bikes to some of the trails nearby, and now I can bring the entire crew, my dog, and all of our gear with that third row. Learn more about the new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
You're tuned in to Heat Check with Trista Crick.
On this episode of the Heat Check, we have a special guest on the show today, James Herbert of CBS Sports. James has been a feature writer for a very long time, was kind enough to carve out an entire hour where we delve into the process of writing about the league, how he chooses his subjects, and what he learned from profiling such under-the-radar stars such as Jose Alvarado, Scotty Barnes, to superstars like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Pascal Siakam. It was a fascinating conversation. I learned a ton. Can't wait to get into it. So do me a favor, my man. Drop that beat. First and foremost, again, thanks for coming on the show. I think you've got one of the funniest feeds on Twitter.
Thank you.
One of the most... It's a cool feed, right? It's got all this stuff. I try to keep up on it, even some things that make it on your feed. I'm like, oh, man, I haven't seen that before. I think NBA Twitter is the best part of Twitter, you know, one of the best at least. What do you think happens to that community if Twitter goes away?
I'm terrified. I have no idea. I don't know where I'm going to go to talk about basketball with people who I don't, like, know personally. I mean, I've got like group texts, I think like everybody's got. I got my work Slack and some other stuff like that, but like, I don't know. I don't want to be on like NBA Reddit all day, but maybe I'll have to be. Maybe I'll have to learn how to use Discord. I have no idea. I never even installed the app. I'm honestly like, I'm not sure. Like, I was watching last night, everybody was talking about, I mean, I was watching games and then I was also listening to one of those Twitter spaces, which had like 20,000 people on it, talking about what might happen generally. People talking about moving to Mastodon and all of this stuff. That's another thing I've yet to try. And I'm just thinking, like, if this is the end, that sucks. Cause like, I mean, a lot of my professional opportunities have come directly because of Twitter. I met my wife on NBA Twitter. Like, that's why I live in Brooklyn. That's why I'm here. Like, yeah, like,
no fucking
this
way.
Is like, yeah. Like, so I mean, on the one hand, like, well, at least like Twitter was around, so that could happen. So maybe it served its purpose for me. But on the other hand, like, this actually is meaningful to me. I know it's stupid. I'm mostly just saying dumb stuff and making jokes and whatever. But like, it is like genuinely been a huge part of my adult life.
I think I have a love-hate relationship with Twitter because so much of it is toxic. But then when you realize it could just go away completely, you're like, well, where am I going to make fun of LeBron, like, for lying? Like, where are the memes going to go? I wonder if we're all sort of feeling that I guess it's like a pre-loss. You know, we haven't lost it yet, but we kind of feel like we're going to, and we're not really sure how we're going to connect if it does go away. You're one of my favorite feature writers in the NBA. How do you go about picking a subject? Like, could you shed some light on your process of how you write a story?
Sure. I mean, part of it is just like, if there's a player I find interesting for whatever reason, and I feel like there's a story to be told that's like a little bit different, or I haven't, maybe I just don't know that much about the guy, or maybe I know some things, but I'm curious about other things. Like, I'll then go and start researching and seeing what other people have written and seeing like, is there something I can add to this? Is there something that I don't know? Then I'll try to pursue it. A lot of times it's not much more complicated than like, I like watching this player and I think I could do a feature on him well. Like the most recent one I did was Jose Alvarado. And like last year, I think like a lot of people, I didn't really know anything about him when he first like got in the Pelicans rotation. Like when I first saw his name, like he wasn't somebody I was paying attention to before the draft. He went undrafted, but I saw him play. I was like, well, this guy, like he plays so freaking hard. Like he is really fun to watch. And then as the season went on, it was like, all right, like this guy is a super fan favorite. He seems like he has an awesome personality. He like clearly has a cool story. And I was just like, I'm definitely profiling him one day. Like I just kind of like said that to myself. It didn't end up happening last year, but like the Pelicans were like literally the first game on the regular season schedule here in Brooklyn. And I knew, I was just like, I'm going to request him and try to make it happen. And then I'll go from there. And that was like sort of a passion project. Like nobody, like I didn't have an editor assigning me a Jose Alvarado story, but like, I just wanted to write about Jose Alvarado because I like watching him play. And I thought there was something to be done there. Other times it could just be that like, I've watched somebody and I've noticed something about their game that is interesting. And like, they've been written about one way. And I think I got to add to it by focusing on something different or like whatever it is. There's a lot of ways you can like start, but I think you like, it has to start from a place of like genuine curiosity, and it has to start from a place of like, I want to do this. Like I want, cause if you're going to like do one of these and write like a fairly long one, rather than just like bust out a column or whatever, which like I do as well. But if I'm going to invest the time to do a profile, like I want to actually find this person interesting. I don't want it to feel like it's a slog and I'm just doing it cause it's my job. Like, these things are hard. Some of them, like last year, I wrote a story that went up like right at the end of the regular season on Scottie Barnes. And the first interview I did was like the first week of the season. And I didn't think it was going to take that long, but that just kind of happened. And sometimes it is, like sometimes it's literal months.
How come? Is it just because you have to, it takes you down a direction and then you have to find sort of people who would, you know, help shed light on the thing that you're, you know, delving into? Like, for example, with Alvarado, you had to speak with Fred VanVleet. Or is that the reason why? Or why does the writing process take so long?
Yeah, well, part of it is probably on me and probably shouldn't take that long in some of these instances where it's taking me like months and months. Yeah, usually it's related to access. Usually it's related to like, I don't think I can tell this story properly without getting like maybe a follow-up interview with the player, or maybe it's an old coach or something that I haven't talked to yet, or a teammate that I want to get when the team comes back to town or whatever it is. But usually it's just like, I have like, I'll start transcribing my stuff and look at what I got and try to outline it. And I'm like, I'm almost there, but like, I need a little bit more. And then the other part of it is, sometimes it's just I'm working on multiple things at the same time and I'm busy with other stuff. And like the like not super urgent, not super time sensitive profile is the thing that ends up getting pushed back. Because if I have to like go to a, I don't know, like go to a Nets practice and write about the latest Kyrie incident, then like that's what I'll do that day instead of like making a phone call about Jose Alvarado or whatever.
Right. Well, I wanted to kind of mention some of the articles you wrote that I wanted to hear a little bit more about. You mentioned the Scottie Barnes article, and that was published on April 8th before he won Rookie of the Year. And you said, you know, you started working on it the first week of the season. What did you find interesting about him, and what did you find interesting or memorable that didn't make the piece?
Like everything is my first answer. Like I was captivated by Scottie Barnes. I was interested in him before the draft because I read a few, like that was the other thing, is like it was sort of intimidating working on that one. So one of the reasons that took a while was I had all these like great long form Scotty Barnes profiles that like I was competing with. Like if I was going to put something out there, I had to have some stuff that wasn't in the other ones. But I read those stories and I was like, this kid is not like a normal, you know, depending on when they were written, 18-year-old, 19-year-old, whatever it was, kid. Like he was a guy that was talking about like being a Magic Johnson fan. He was a guy who, I mean, he was picked fourth in the draft, but was coming off the bench for most of the season at Florida State and was like happy with it, not complaining about it. He was a guy that oftentimes when people were kind of trying to explain why he was viewed so highly despite these like supposed flaws in his game, like why, okay, this guy is not necessarily a one-on-one scorer yet based on what he's done in college. He's not necessarily ever going to be like a go-to guy and whatever. This is like, to be clear, scouting reports at the time. I think he showed more of that in the NBA, but at the time it was like, but he is so good at everything else and people love him and he wants to make guys better. And people just like, you talk to him and you believe in him. Like the, a lot of the reasons for why people thought highly of him, a lot of the reasons for why the Raptors were confident taking him and taking him, by the way, when like they knew it was going to be seen by a lot of people as a huge risk, as frankly, the wrong pick. A lot of people immediately said it was the wrong pick, but they were betting on the upside and the upside was based on, yeah, he's this like, 6'7", 6'8" guy with like a super long wingspan and he's like really agile and skilled and all that. But I think more than that, it was the person. It was like, we think he has the super high ceiling and we think he's likely to get there because of who he is. And all of that was like just a little bit different to me. And I just kind of wanted to know more about him. I want to know exactly what you know, his old coaches had to say about what he was like. He had an interesting family story, which didn't end up actually being that big of a part of my story. But yeah, it was kind of, it was a combination. Sometimes I'm drawn more to like the backstory and sometimes I'm drawn more to like the way they play on the court. But for me, it was both for him. Like I remember watching him in the preseason last year and being like, every time he's on the court, the Raptors are more interesting to me. And every time he goes to the bench, I'm a little like let's get Scotty back in there. Like part of that was, I think he was new, but part of that was like, he is like a really exciting player to watch. I was just drawn to that guy like immediately.
What did you find in your sort of story search process that you found even more interesting than what you had originally thought?
I think with Scotty, he had this combination of, how do I put this? Like, he doesn't come off as arrogant. Like, he talks a lot about, you know, what's best for the team, just wanting to do what the coach asks them. Like, even in my research, I remember finding, like, a game winner he had hit at Florida State, and he, like, basically didn't want to give himself any credit for making the game winner. While at the same time, like if you talk to people around him and even if you ask him like direct questions about his own game, like he has this belief in himself and this confidence that is like not it's not humble. It's not it's like he believes that he belongs and he always kind of has. And I think he's had a vision for himself, honestly, since he was in high school of like, I'm going to get to the NBA. And when I get there, I'm not going to be just another NBA player. There's another story that came out after mine that I was jealous of, where it was like a list of his like affirmations and goals. And like one of them was like, I want to be the best player on the court at all times when I'm on the court. Like one of them was like, I want to win Rookie of the Year. And it's like to step into a situation like that, where even though like what he's saying, like when he's asked about like, you know, the team and his rookie season, he's like, I just want to fit in. I want to make other guys better. I want everybody to be smiling and having fun and all that. That's all true. But he also believes that like doing it that way, like he can dominate a game that way. And
interesting.
I think he is a guy that like, yes, the Raptors have had to like work with him on like being more assertive and aggressive and looking to score, because then if you're seen as a huge threat scoring, like you can go do the thing you actually want to do, which is pass the ball and then rack up a bunch of assists and be a point guard. But at the same time as them trying to like make him be more aggressive that way, I don't think that's this thing where he's like looking at this situation kind of like unsure of himself or intimidated or anything like that. I think he truly has had a plan and he's like been pretty bold about following that plan and working toward it. Even like the way that he approached the pre-draft stuff like a year and a half ago, where he like very clearly like wanted to show teams that he could do a few things that were sort of like seen as knocks on him and show teams like, I've gotten better since the end of last year. And you're going to see that if you get in the gym with me. And also like, I have a plan for these interviews where you're going to come out of here like loving me and wanting to spend more time with me. And you're going to be texting me after these interviews. And they were like executives were doing that. Like, I think it is who he is. It comes very naturally to him. It's easy for him, but I think also like he's very smart and I think he sees the big picture. And I think he is like, you know, he kind of had a blueprint for what he wanted to be from a pretty young age. And like, I had absolutely no idea about any of that before I started reporting it.
Wow. Yeah.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
And you mentioned point guards. Another piece I thought was super interesting was your last piece on Jose Alvarado. And I was reading it, and there's a bunch of different guards in the mix that you interviewed and that were referenced. And I guess the first question that I have is, do you think that his success, because I think it came out of nowhere, and, you know, he was ACC defensive player, but still undrafted. Do you think that this success that he's had, success that guards like Fred VanVleet have had, does that pave the way? Is this like a trend, do you think, that's happening where undersized players can come in and be really valuable role players?
I hope so, because I love those kinds of players. But I think the trend is not to me about undersized players exactly, because I think it's getting harder and harder for smaller guards to stay in the league. But I think if you are one of those guys that plays taller, if you're one of those guys that can switch a little bit, then compete against bigger players that can hold their own, then yeah, it's just like the bar is getting higher. And I think probably one of the reasons why he went undrafted, people just looked at him as a small guard. And now that he's in the NBA, it's like, well, he plays as if he has no idea that he's a small guard. He plays as if he thinks he's 6'9". And that's exactly how VanVleet plays. That's how, you know, Alex Caruso is one of the guys that was quoted in the story that I think that's who Alvarado had told him, like, you paved the way for me. Like, I saw what you did to go from a two-way to like being a rotation player in the league and all of that. I think Fred VanVleet didn't tell me exactly what Alvarado told him when they spoke, but it sounded like a kind of similar deal. Like, I think Alvarado saw in those guys a kind of path for himself, and I think there's a reason. It's like those guys defend like crazy, and they have offensive skills as well. I mean, Fred VanVleet's an all-star at this point. Yeah. But I think the idea is, if you can be an elite defender at the guard spot, then you can survive. If your teammates have to cover for you all the time, and if you can't guard multiple positions and all of that, then like you basically have to be a superstar now on the offensive end to survive. But I do think at least in terms of like defense first, like really, really intense, competitive, smart, like the guys that are in the right places and manage to affect a game on both ends. Like if those guys are coming out of college, if those guys are coming out of wherever and teams can get a scout on them, they at least have guys they can compare them to, right? Like if they say, we think he can be sort of like a Van Vliet or like an Alvarado or whoever, I think that helps.
Yeah.
It's just like, I think you have to sort of be careful when like, I don't want to start to say like every guy Alvarado size can do that, because if they could, then Alvarado wouldn't stand out that much, and we'd be seeing more guys that size kind of make it. And I think what we're actually seeing is the opposite. Like the bar is getting higher and higher and higher if you're a small guy.
Yeah, which makes him even more of a unicorn. I think that's what makes and his teammate Herb Jones so fascinating too, yeah, is all the things that he can do defensively and his quote. I mean, Scottie Barnes, Alvarado, and Herb Jones, all guys that lead the way with defense, really. And that are good passers and can kind of be unicorns in their own way and haven't been seen as these like offensive, you know, firepowers, you know?
Yeah. I think I love when Herb Jones and Alvarado are on the court together. Like I think some of those, especially when like when the Pelicans have Larry Nance at the five spot, like they're closing the games most of the time with Nance at the five. Now, the last few games, Jose's played the whole like fourth quarter and started with that Houston game where he basically dominated it. But the Pelicans are like, they have a ton of firepower. Like their team is built to be an elite offense, even though the shooting isn't that great. Like they just destroy teams on the inside. And I think what you're looking at from now until the end of the season is like, can they find that balance of like all that firepower being that efficient offensive team while also getting enough stops to beat the best teams in the NBA. And I think Willie Green's playing around with the lineups to try to get to that point. And I really like the look that they've been going with lately in the fourth quarter where Alvarado has been on the court and Nance has been on the court. It gets trickier to like slot Herb Jones into that lineup when it's like crunch time, because you have Ingram and CJ and Zion on the team. But like throughout the game, you can see the Pelicans get to some really good defensive lineups, even if they're not like a top flight defensive team.
Is it more difficult for Willie Green, in your opinion, to make decisions now that Zion and when Zion is healthy?
In a way, I think he enhances what they do. He lets them do a lot more, but I think they're still doing a lot of experimenting. The point Zion stuff that we saw from, you know, the last time he was healthy when Van Gundy was the coach, that was like so exciting. But it was obviously going to look different when he came back, because like it's a completely different team now. It's a new coach. CJ McCollum was not on the team before. The bench is like totally different now. But I mean, just finding the space within a game, even finding a space within just a possession to be like, all right, we're empowering Zion to be the decision maker here, the playmaker here. Like it gets a little trickier because CJ needs his possessions doing that. Brandon Ingram needs his possessions doing that. You have other guys like Jose Alvarado, Devontae Graham, Dyson Daniels all think of themselves as point guards. They are not always the guy bringing the ball up the court when they're on the floor, but just by virtue of the fact that all these guys are on the team and getting minutes means there's going to be fewer possessions that Zion Williamson is like bringing the ball up and doing that. And we know he's so good at that. And it's only in recent games that Zion has gotten to do that stuff a little bit more. And I still don't think they have found the like just natural, easy rhythm of like, we are just flowing from one action to another where like Zion and CJ are playing in harmony and making each other better and all of this stuff. I think they're still working through all of that.
Yeah.
And I think where their offensive numbers are, despite that, is like pretty impressive because they're kind of still in preseason mode. Like they're still in experimentation mode. Zion missed some time. Ingram missed some time. CJ was shooting like terribly to start the year for some reason. But I think the ceiling's really high. It's just they have that stuff to balance and they just have a lot of good players. So the rotation is not obvious and simple. It's a good problem to have, but it's also like a legit problem. And like those decisions, once you start talking later in the season, once they've had the time and once they kind of know what's what, like when you're in a playoff series and you're figuring out who you're going to start, you're going to close games with, who's going to play with whom, like that stuff can like swing an entire game and like swing an entire series. So they do have like a sort of serious thing to do here, which is like basically figuring out like how the chemistry is going to work.
There's like a lot of one-sided players on this team. A lot of good players. You put them together in a different way and they really complement each other well. But, you know, I guess Brandon Ingram's probably the best guy who's in terms of like balanced offensively and defensively. And that makes things tricky, I think, in terms of just what that lineup looks like. Another really great defender that you featured was Shea. I love Shea so much. I think he's one of the most underrated players in the league. This year, he's finally, I feel like, he's broken through to mainstream, you know? I feel like he was every, like, hoop heads, you know, one of their favorite watches last year until he got shut down due to whatever, injury or tanking or both. And now it's like, yeah, he's there, you know, 40-point games, game winners. What was the process of you deciding you wanted to feature him and, like, when did that pop into your mind?
So that one wasn't as like intensive as some of the other ones we talked about. That was basically like the Thunder in town. And I knew I wanted to write about his defense. He is maybe the most improved player in the NBA right now, even without the defensive improvement. he's been so crazy. Like the reason why it seems like he is getting all this attention he didn't used to, even though he was so great last year, like he's third in the league in scoring. Like he's like Ja Morant, isn't averaging as many points in the paint as Shea is this year. And Ja was like,
I think he leads the league in drives per game.
He does. I mean, he has I think this is the third straight year he's led the league in drives per game, but he is so much better in terms of like the finishing numbers. He is actually weirdly, like he's shooting far fewer threes, but it doesn't matter because his mid-range numbers are completely insane. His usage is like near the top of the league. Just what he's doing night to night is so difficult, but yet he makes it look so easy on the offensive end. Where it looks like it's hard is the other end, where I think he clearly, like if you go and watch the tape from his rookie year of the Clippers versus what he was doing most nights with the Thunder the last few years, like it was different and it was understandable. But he always had this defensive potential, he just wasn't quite doing it. And I mean, I just wanted to kind of ask him some questions about that, ask Mark Dagno about that, ask teammates about that, because I thought like, it's just so impressive that he's doing both at the same time. You don't usually see the big jump on both ends. And he has been on it. Like he's been locked in pretty much every game. The Thunder have not been amazing defensively every game, but they have overall had a really good defense, especially in the half court.
Poku shut Al Horford down.
Dude, Poku is like so fun to watch right now. And it's not even because he's doing all this like crazy, like, oh my God, like how did this guy do that? It's just like, he's just being solid, which I don't think is like what people were always anticipating out of Poku, is that he'd be like a good complimentary role player because he just looked like such a weird prospect with such a high ceiling. And like, he still has that ceiling, but I think it's cool that he has like settled into being like a kind of normal player right now. That's actually somebody else I want to write about. But
I literally in my head was like, that'd be a perfect James Herbert.
We're trying here. Yeah. But whether or not I get to write that, like it has been fun watching him do that. And like what Shea is doing, just like being disruptive off the ball, giving more effort on the ball. It's kind of like a little bit of everything. And then the numbers are nuts. Like he's like second in the league in stocks, if that were a real category. He's up there in deflections. He's like second in steals. Like it's the work he's putting in on that end, in addition to just the like ridiculous load that he's carrying offensively, is really impressive. And like you don't see a lot of guys doing that.
And they brought over Chip England from San Antonio, the shot doctor, who's just known for improving players' 3-point shots by like 3%. Period, pretty much everywhere he goes, everything he does, right? What do you think Shea is if he has like a consistent 3-point shot?
I mean, it's funny because it's like, I want to say like, oh, he's unguardable, but like, I sort of think he's unguardable now.
Now unguardable.
So it's like, does it, I guess it makes guys close out a little hard on him. It makes guys like basically never go under screens, I guess that would help. But it's like he's just such a unique, like he's just such a different player. Like what he does is distinct from what like somebody like Jaw even does. What he does is probably a little more similar to what Chris Paul does, who he surely learned from when they were teammates for a year. But it's just, it is even different from that because it's all about like angles. It's this herky jerky thing to keep defenses off guard. It's not about like getting a step and then like just full on accelerating, blowing by guys. Like he's not fast, but he's usually not going super fast. Like he's making quick moves. But I don't even think he needs like a lights out pull up jumper or anything. Like he is a good spot up shooter now. And it's just, you're seeing him take fewer of those spot up shots because he's usually the one creating the offense this year. I mean, that could change depending on who's on the team. But I think you've seen him basically make a conscious choice this year. Like, I don't need to look for that pull up three, because I can get wherever the hell I want. And I can get a bucket whenever my team needs it. Yeah.
Almost like DeRozan-esque in some ways, in terms of angles and mid-range. But a lot of people do compare Shea and Ja to one another. Why do you think that is?
I think because they're both such good finishers. They're both really young. They're both exciting. But I do think there are like key differences in terms of their style. Like, I mean, Shea would never be the kind of athlete that Ja could be. And while they're both like crafty and smart and cerebral players for sure, Shea's just like, there's just kind of nobody like him. I think, honestly, like besides James Harden, I can't think of another like downhill driver as good as Shea in like, I don't know, like decades. The numbers sort of speak for themselves. Like you can't, there's not really a defense equipped to deal with him right now. I thought it spoke volumes when the Celtics were just throwing double teams at him the other day, because they never do that. But yeah. I think combination of the fact that like that was their best strategy because nobody was shutting him down one-on-one, and the fact that they were basically like, all right, like he is their number one, two, and three option. It's not like somebody else, like we're scared of them, so we're just going to get the ball out of his hands. Like that led them down that path. But I think that was like the ultimate sign of respect, that like the Boston Celtics, who have Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum and all of these guys, are just like, yeah, actually what we're going to do is we're going to put two of those guys on you.
You talk about just like sort of how hard it is for small players to be in this league, because, you know, the league's getting like more versatile. I interviewed Nick Nurse during summer league. We spent about an hour together, and he mentioned to me kind of in detail what he wants from a player, and 6'7" to 6'9" with a positive wingspan that can do all the things that a point guard can do and all the things that a big can do is something that I think, you know, in your article, it's, you know, how the NBA is resizing again leads me now to think about Paolo. And I watched him at the Garden, and I saw him, and they had Franz Wagner running the point, and everyone on the floor was like 6'9". They don't win a lot of games, but do you think that size could actually contend? Is that a winning lineup now in the NBA?
Well, not Orlando's version, but I think that idea is like can win games now. I think Toronto overachieved for that reason last year. I was like that Garden. That's where I did all those interviews. Like I was at that game, and like that's where I spoke to Paolo, and that's where I spoke to Wendell and Terrence Ross and Cole Anthony and all that. Like that was not unusual though. Like that's every game this year, and part of that is based on stuff they can't control and didn't anticipate. Yes. So like Markel hasn't played this year. Gary Harris, I think, is about to make his season debut. You know, Jalen Suggs missed a game or two earlier on. Cole Anthony's been out for a little while. Like this has been their best option because they haven't had a lot of other options. But I think in the past, like even, I don't think that long ago, like I think 4 or 5 years ago, if a team was dealing with this kind of thing, you would see them call up a like traditional point guard from the G League or something.
Yeah.
And they just, no, we don't need to do that. Why? Like, why should we just give it to Wagner, give it to Paolo? Like, we need to get those guys playmaking reps anyway. Like, they're going to maybe lose some games because of it, but this is what they're trying to develop in their guys regardless. And it's, to me, it's very similar to what the Raptors were doing. It's just some of the lineups are even bigger because they happen to have a 7'2" Bol Bol on their team who plays like a wing and like basically like believes he's a wing. Like if you watch the stuff that he does, like it makes perfect sense. And then also their other bigs, like on offense, they're all stationed along the 3-point line and they're, you know, it's not that they are knockdown guys, but if their feet are set and if they're in rhythm, like there's no, why would Mosley not allow Mo Bamba and Wendell Carter to shoot threes? You should, like that is where the league is going. And I think defensively the upside of having that much length and that much size is like pretty obvious. These guys are very young, so the Magic are not an elite defense right now. But I think even when it wasn't so extreme, like last year, just seeing the front line before they got Paolo, like when they had Wagner and Wendell Carter and Mo Bamba in the front court, like that was a really good defensive unit. And that was an interesting like front court to watch offensively. It's just you introduce a talent like Paolo, who's just insane and like might be the best passer on the team, as well as being a guy that is like a walking mismatch. He can go in the post, he can isolate, like do all of this stuff. Like that is what like everybody is looking for in the NBA. I don't think people think of him as like this like crazy unicorn freak, like generational, like what even is this, the way that people talk about like Wemby, or even the way people like when they first saw Chet a few years ago would have said it. But like to me, like the skill package that he has as an offensive player at that size is kind of mind-blowing. Like he is an enormous guy when you stand next to him, and he plays exactly like a guard.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that because he's so proportional. And You hear the size, like you hear 6'10", 250, but seeing 6'10", 250 is just different, right? Yeah. Like he's bigger, and I always do it like, all right, well, he's 2 inches bigger than LeBron, you know?
Yeah.
He's like just a little shorter than Mitchell Robinson, like maybe even the same height. Like it's just sort of nuts. Or what was it? Hartenstein. He was just like a little bit shorter than when you actually got in front of him face to face. Can you sort of explain that? Because I've never had that with any player in the league, because they're all sort of out of proportion except for LeBron, but it's just somehow it's different.
Yeah, I think the way that I put it is there are certain rookies that just do not look like rookies whatsoever. Honestly, Scotty is kind of like that last year. Like I remember watching him just in, like not even in person, like just watching him on TV in summer league and being like, oh, he's like bullying guys, like cool. And then you see him do the same thing to like NBA veterans, and you're like, all right, this guy is like kind of built in a different way than most of these guys, because like a lot of times it's normal, it makes sense. These rookies come in, it takes them like 2, 3, 4 years for them to get strong enough to like just survive the rigors of a season and take contact on the inside and all of that. And like Paolo is just, he is not that at all. Like he was just a physically dominant in college, and I think a lot of the time when a guy is physically dominant in college, the question is, all right, is he skilled enough to do this at the next level when he doesn't have that advantage every night? And it turns out, well, A, yes, because he's skilled as hell, and B, like the vast majority of the time he still has that advantage, because if you're going to put a guy that is quick enough to guard him and stay with him, a lot of the time he's going to be just stronger, bigger, more powerful. And if you're going to try to put a bigger dude on him, a lot of the time Paolo can just like go right by him. I think you're seeing like a trend of tall kids being more skilled and thus young players being bigger and more skilled every year. So like, I don't know what Paolo's like advantage over the average kind of four man or whatever, if we're even talking those positions like 5-6 years from now, I don't know what that will look like. But as of now, I mean, there are guys who can like credibly guard him, but it's not a long list.
Yeah, no, it's not. And offensively, he's super gifted. Like you said, just an incredible passer. His vision, willingness to pass, I think it's really interesting.
Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You mentioned that sometimes you have to do non-features, like go to Barclays and listen to Kyrie. And you wrote a ton about...
I think tomorrow I'll be doing that. I'm guessing since he's supposed to play Sunday, I'm guessing he'll practice tomorrow and he'll talk.
Yeah. What are your, like, what's your take on kind of what happens next? And does it die down at all? Or do we see this kind of for the rest of the year?
Well, I think it's up to him. I think the bar has been raised pretty high just looking at all of these statements that are coming out about how we, like, basically people vouching for him, whether it's Jaylen Brown, other people in the Players Association, whether it's like just public comments even from Adam Silver and Joe Tsai saying that he believes Kyrie is sincere, like all of this stuff. The Nets have set the stage for him to return. It's been reported that he is, like, expected to return on Sunday, but, like, as far as I know, even though he is not necessarily bound at this point by the reported list of six action items or whatever, I'm assuming the one about him speaking to the media and kind of disavowing specific parts of the film directly, I'm guessing that's still part of it. And so, like, let's see what he says, because he had a couple opportunities to do just that. And he had a week to think about whether or not he wanted to, and he, like, very specifically didn't. He was defiant and he didn't want to say that he did anything wrong exactly, and he didn't really want to get into the details of what he disagreed with and what he agreed with. And in his apology on Instagram, like, he said he apologized for not explicitly stating what he agreed with and disagreed with. Okay, he's apologized. He hasn't done that yet, though. So will he do that when we ask him the questions? Like, I don't know. I'll be there, and it's a kind of a hard setting to get a question in. So I haven't gotten that many questions directly into Kyrie when I've been there, but I'll try. But even if I don't, like, I know, like, you know, the other Nets, like, Nick Friedell is going to get some awesome questions in there because he's been, like, killing it on the story the whole time. Like, so I am fascinated to see where it goes, but, I mean, I don't know how I can make a prediction at this point. I just know that, like, the burden is, like, definitively on him because everybody's kind of stuck their neck out for him and said that they believe that his intentions are pure and all of this stuff. And, like, that's what happened in a much smaller way already when the Nets and he and the Anti-Defamation League put out a statement. And then the next day, frankly, like, Kyrie embarrassed himself and the ADL and the Nets for putting out that statement. So if he does it again, like, if who is he embarrassing? He's embarrassing a lot more people, and it's going to be way worse because it followed that other thing. So I hope that, like, he comes out and he clearly states he disagrees with, like, the thesis of the film. And he, like, explains himself a little bit and explains what he's been doing over the past, I don't know, week and a half, however long, 2 weeks, however long it's been. And that he demonstrates that, like, he kind of gets it, but I don't know. It wasn't, like, fun to write the article that I did about the Kyrie thing. Like, I'd much rather just talk about basketball and cover, like, there's, like, Nets basketball storylines that are interesting. But I haven't written a ton about that, honestly, this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I just have a couple of other non-feature article related questions, because just as a fan, I grew up in Portland, and Damian Lillard, obviously a one-way guard, you know, and kind of an undersized one-way guard. Obviously a superstar offensively, but always been a defensive liability. Portland for the last three years, obviously that 2019 Western Conference Finals run, they were a decent defensive team, but kind of not really. And I didn't really think that there was ever a way for a Damian Lillard-led team to be top five, top seven, top 10 in defense. But here they are, right? Like they bring in Jeremy Grant and they get some sort of undersized wings, but that are very gritty and athletic and have some of those same attributes that you mentioned that Jose Alvarado has. Like, in your viewpoint, when you watch the Blazers, how are they doing this defensively?
They're doing it by being super active. They're doing it by being super aggressive, and they're fighting. They're using what they do have. Like it's a little different. Like if they have Nurkic on the court versus if they're playing smaller. But they, even when he's on the court, like if he is, regardless of like what coverage that he's playing, like they need the wings to be covering ground and helping and recovering. And like those guys are doing that. Like they have length on the perimeter. They have better point of attack defense. I liked what I've seen from like Justice Winslow this season. Jeremy Grant, I think, has fit in as well as they'd hoped. Nasir Little, you saw some, honestly, I think he was like better, like as a more complete like two-way player before he got hurt last year. But I mean, defensively, he's still got those attributes. He's still able to contribute that. And you've seen that from him. The wild thing to me is like, I think they're the best defender they have on the team hasn't played yet. And that's Gary Payton II. And that can add a whole other dimension. I mean, he might be like the literal best one-on-one defender in the NBA. He is probably not going to win any Defensive Player of the Year awards because he's not going to play like 30 plus minutes. And it's hard for a non-big to do that. But I mean, he's like wildly good and they haven't even had him. And he's a guy that can switch. He can play like guard bigger guys. And then as a guy that can like just pressure opposing point guards, I don't think there's anybody better. So like, I've liked the approach. I've liked the coaching from Chauncey Billups there, just trying to be disruptive, trying to get in passing lanes, trying to speed other teams up, trying to just put some pressure on them in a different way. Like they had historically played a pretty conservative style of defense. Chauncey tried to change that last year, but he didn't really have the personnel for it to be effective. But I think, I mean, I haven't spoken to him about this, but I'm guessing what he would say is that like, even what they did last year, they were losing almost every night, but he was still laying the groundwork for what they're doing now. Because before they even got the personnel that could make it work, they're teaching some of the personnel like how to do it. And so I think it looks a lot better now. I love that they're playing a ton of zone. I think you kind of have to do that if you are trying to make up for, say, like a lack of like mobile big men, or maybe you're just trying to make up for having a couple of guards who were not super sturdy defensively. Because like Simons is bigger than CJ, but in theory, it's like basically the same issue that they had when it was CJ and Dame. But I mean, they're doing their best to mask that. I think Dame has, I mean, I guess it depends which season you're looking at, but I think for the most part in his career, like, yeah, he's been a below average defender. He has sometimes in certain matchups been like a straight up liability, but I think he does like care about defense. He's not like a horrific defender. He can be in the right place. He is a very smart basketball player. So like, as long as he's like not dying on too many screens, as long as like he is basically in the right place and executing a coverage, like I think you can make up for his deficiencies on the defensive end. It might stop you from being like the number one defense over the course of an 82 game season, but I mean, they're doing like really well right now. And I do think their ceiling will be higher once they get Payton integrated. But I mean, it's just been fun. Like, it's fun to see that team getting stops and running. It's fun to see them sort of looking like they're more than the sum of their parts. And like, you know, they just have a bunch of new energy in there. And like, even like I'm watching Shaedon Sharpe, who did not have a sterling defensive reputation, coming into the NBA, but like, you know, he's switching on to stars and competing, at least on the defensive end. And he's long and he might make mistakes and whatever, but like, he's a big dude, he's an athlete, and he's trying. And I think everybody on the Blazers really bought into the game plan on the defensive end. So that has been a treat to watch.
Yeah, I agree. I think this team could be a real – I didn't believe it at first, but I think this team could be an actual dark horse, given how wide open the West is, issues with the Warriors, issues with the Grizzlies in terms of, you know, you take Bane out, you take Jaw out, and you really have a bad team. You know what I mean? I watched them play the Wizards the other day, and without Jaw and Bane, it is really ugly to watch. Like, Jaren Jackson, obviously an up-and-down player. Another player I think I could see you featuring – very interesting dude, Jeremy Sochan. Just another darling of the NBA, I think, right away. What comes to mind, you just see him that dunk last night. Just like Rodman 2.0, like the body, the moves, the swag, like.
Yeah.
What do you think?
No, so I will say, I wrote about him right at the draft. So you nailed my interest in him. Like I spoke to him, I think the day before the draft, and I just found him so interesting. The story moved around all over the place, just has a kind of different perspective on basketball. And I mean, you watch him, even like look at him in college, like he's legitimately guarding all five positions. I think people say that, and it sounds nice, but the amount of people who actually do that night to night in the NBA, like it's a very, very short list, but like he does that. And he's doing that in the NBA. The other night when they were shorthanded, like to watch, like Pop's just like, yeah, we're going to make him the point guard. And he's the point guard. He's bringing it up. And then he's playing point guard defensively because he was matched up the primary defender on Stephen Curry, like chasing him around screens. And he loves it. You can tell like he's like a sicko. Like he lives to do this stuff. He lives to annoy the hell out of people defensively. I don't know if you saw the Steven Adams quote from after that game, but that was like just like the funniest thing that's happened this season.
He's like pinching Steven Adams nipples.
Super weird, but like incredible. And then I know he's not like the most polished offensive player or whatever, but like he's an incredible passer. He is a strong physical guy who like when he gets downhill can finish. Like he's not unskilled offensively. Just the shot is coming along and he's not a great like scorer yet, but you can see it. You can see why the Spurs fell in love with him. And it's like, it's this like really cool mix of hustle guy, defensive stopper, but then also like legit playmaker, smart player, mature guy. Interesting guy, fun guy. Like he is like, I'm absolutely like all in on the Sochan experience. I love that he took Rodman's number and is dyeing his hair all different colors. He did that a little bit at Baylor last year too. And I think he's just, I mean, even just like he was beloved at Baylor and like he gets to stay in Texas. Like I saw like he had that big dunk last night and Scott Drew like tweeted out the highlight. And I was like, yeah, that's nice. Like I'm all in on this guy's story. He's awesome.
Well, we'll have to do this again sometime soon. Enjoy or at least get through the Kyrie coverage. Hopefully, hopefully that comes to an end soon and we get to see another feature. Do you have any other plans of any features that we should watch out for?
I feel like I said too much with the Poku thing already. I don't know if I'm actually doing that, but I want to. I'll see what comes together. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, that's been awesome. Where can we find your work?
Just at cbsports.com in the NBA section. That's where all of my stuff ends up.
And hopefully Twitter still.
I tweet my stories. I will keep doing that as long as we have a working functional website. We'll see.
Awesome. If not, I'll see you wherever I see you, James. It's 100% appreciated. Awesome insight. Awesome energy and excitement. I can tell you love the league about as much as I do.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, talk to you soon. Thanks so much. Many thanks to James Herbert for joining the show today. That is all the time that we have for the Heat Check. Check out the feed for past episodes and mini episodes, which drop pretty much every day. Follow the Heat Check as the season is heating up. Do not forget to download. Please subscribe. Please tell your friends, every single damn one of them. And follow us on social at This Heat Check and at Trista Crick on TikTok, Twitter, whenever it stays around, and Instagram.